Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. Our time is very tight, so I'll try and start us as close to on time as possible. As we've heard a lot about at this conference today, and as I'm sure you're all aware, the developers of DSM-5 have just begun thinking about issues of development and how the criteria for the diagnosis of disorders in the stress response spectrum might need to be adjusted to be most effective in detecting PTSD and acute stress disorder in children and adolescents. So I'm very pleased today to be able to bring together some of the people who have been really leading the field in thinking about how those criteria need to be made more developmentally sensitive and developmentally appropriate. For the purposes of time, I'd like to ask that people hold questions till the end, and I promise to reserve about 10 minutes of time for discussion. And so with that very briefest of intro, I won't take any more of the presenter's time. And I'm very pleased to begin with Dr. Michael Scheringa from Tulane University, who will be speaking on making PTSD criteria developmentally appropriate.
Thank you, and thank you for organizing this and inviting me. No commercial relationship to disclose. I'm going to start with preschool children, and we'll talk a bit about school age and teens later. First, there's multiple challenges with the preschool age population. First of all, many of the PTSD items are internalized. They're going on inside a person's head or body, and if the child doesn't have the verbal skills to verbalize those, they're very hard to know that those symptoms are occurring. And children in the 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old range are just developing their verbal skills and their autobiographical narrative skills, so it makes these symptoms difficult to detect. And then also some of the symptoms are just manifest themselves differently in this age group, and I'm going to walk through the differences on the next few slides. And if you want more detail about this, I've written several things, and other people have, and this is one reference up there if you want to get more detail. So what we've done over a series of studies, and other people at other sites have done too, is look at an alternative algorithm or alternative diagnostic criteria for preschool age children. And I'm going to walk through really quickly the recommendations we and others have made for modifying their criteria over the years. First of all, the A2 item, that the person's response at the time of the event involved helplessness, fear, or horror, we've suggested to delete that for one reason. If children can't relay what their experience was back then, you won't know it. And if an adult wasn't there to observe their experience, you can't know what happened. If they have all the other symptoms of PTSD, but you can't know this item, it doesn't seem fair to deny them the diagnosis based on that. And it's also being recommended for adults, too. And DSM-5 to delete this. And then, the item, the re-experiencing item of recurrent and intrusive distressing recollections, we have found empirically that a lot of times preschool children seem eager to say their intrusive recollections. A child will be at the checkout lane in the store and say to the cashier, "My daddy beat up my mommy." And it just doesn't obviously look like distress. It just, that's one of these developmental manifestations that can be different. So we've suggested not requiring distress. It's a slight change, just to change the wording for face validity. The big change is in cluster C. The DSM-IV has required 3 out of 7 items for the diagnosis, and the short story is we suggest only requiring 1 out of 7. That's because a lot of these cluster C items are internalized, difficult to know, and some of them are just plain developmentally inappropriate, like sense of a foreshortened future. Within the cluster C, some other changes in the wording for face validity is instead of diminished interest in significant activities, change the wording a bit just to note that their significant activities are play and social relationships. They often don't have school, they don't have work, they don't have hobbies, so we just to emphasize that point. The feeling of detachment or estrangement from others, and that's an internalized phenomenon, so we've changed the wording to make it more behavioral and observable as social withdrawal. Not changing the intent of the symptom, just changing the wording a bit. Then in the increased arousal cluster, the item irritability or outbursts of anger can look in small children as their temper tantrums. So just, again, slight change in the wording to make it better for face validity. This is a list of studies that have examined a version of an alternative criteria set with head-to-head comparisons to the DSM-IV. In the first green column there on the left lists the rate of diagnosis by DSM-IV in these studies. The middle column is the percent of diagnosis by an alternative algorithm for preschool children. And you can see every time the rate of diagnosis with the alternative algorithm is 3 times or higher than the DSM-IV. Now, skeptics may think, well, aren't you just diagnosing mildly symptomatic kids because you've made that big change in the cluster C that it requires only 1 instead of 3 items? So that's what the third column is for, to show that the mean number of PTSD symptoms by kids diagnosed by an alternative algorithm is still 6 to 10 symptoms. However, that also includes those diagnosed by the DSM-IV. So the real test is the misclassified cases, and that's the last 2 rows. Looking at the kids who do not qualify for a DSM-IV diagnosis, but do get a diagnosis by an alternative algorithm, their mean number of symptoms in those last 2 rows is still 6 to 7 symptoms. That's extremely symptomatic. Usually a cutoff for a clinical trial for PTSD is to have 5 symptoms or more, and these kids easily meet that, even with this lower threshold for the algorithm. I want to present a little new data from a recent study that we've completed and just gotten published. We collected the largest sample to date of 3 to 6-year-old children, and we tried to do it by different trauma types. That was the focus of the study. We recruited kids who just had single event traumas like car accidents and acute injuries, repeated events children, and this is usually kids who witnessed domestic violence. And then Hurricane Katrina hit in the middle of the study, so we got a Hurricane Katrina group. This is a list of collaborators and the funding source by NIMH. Here's a list of the groups, 62 in the single group, 85 in the repeated group, 137 in the Katrina group. There were some differences in socio-demographics by the nature of their recruitment. The repeated group who experienced domestic violence, they had very few fathers in the home, as expected. By the recruitment strategy. Hurricane Katrina group is a little better educated, a little different race composition because Hurricane Katrina cut across all economic lines. The thing I want to point out is the last row, the number of episodes. Usually studies count the number of types of trauma. So if you had 100 episodes of physical abuse, that's usually only counted as one type. That's never made any sense to me. So we counted the number of actual episodes, and you can see the repeated group certainly had repeated trauma. And the Hurricane Katrina group was a little bit more similar to the single blow group, but still had more trauma episodes. Just a small footnote at the bottom, it's not something I want to dwell on, but there were no differences between groups on the number of PTSD symptoms or the clusters of PTSD symptoms. This is a kind of a side debate going on in the field of whether different types of trauma cause different kinds of symptom pictures. We don't see that in preschool kids, at least. So DSM-5, that's going to be published in 2013, and this is a very exciting development. It's going to include the first developmental subtype ever of a disorder. And they can have post-traumatic stress disorder in preschool children. And it's basically going to incorporate all of those recommendations that I just showed you on their previous slides. There's one change from all of that, and that's in the restricted range of affect symptom. For some reason that happens when committees get together in the absence of any data, they you can't tell my feelings about it, can you? They decided to restrict the range of emotions only to the positive emotions. So we could look at that. Fortunately, in our data set of these 284 kids, we collected data on whether their affect was restricted on just the negative emotions or just on the positive emotions. They also suggested two totally new symptoms. They've called the under consideration symptoms. I'll shorten that to the UC abbreviation. Substantially increased frequency of negative emotional states, for example, fear, guilt, sadness, shame, or confusion, and recklessness or self-destructive behavior. Again, this is what committees do when they get together. There's no data on these symptoms in preschool children that they exist. There's enormously problematic symptoms. It goes against everything we've been saying for 18 years about how to create symptoms for preschool children. The first one overlaps with existing symptoms about distress at reminders and avoidance of reminders. Can be internalized, difficult to tell that these symptoms exist. Nevertheless, this provides an opportunity to look at another way of diagnosing kids. So, with our data set, we could look at all these three different diagnoses: the PTSD-AA, the algorithm that we've been studying and others have for years, the DSM-5 that contains those recommendations and has this change in the restricted range of affect symptoms, and the DSM-5-UC, which has those two new symptoms included. Now, we didn't have the greatest measures of those two new symptoms because we didn't anticipate those were going to be in there, but we had fairly good proxies of those symptoms in other diagnostic modules of depression and ADHD kind of things. And you can see that if the child had DSM-4 diagnosis, 100% of the time they had one of these alternative diagnoses. That's no surprise because of the lower threshold. It's what we expect. The big thing to focus on here is if they didn't meet criteria for DSM-4, then could they? How often did they meet one of these alternative diagnoses? 37% of the time they got the AA, 36% of the time they got the DSM-5. So there's really no difference between the PTSD-AA and the DSM-5, really. Maybe slight decrease because of that change in restricted affect. And then the DSM-5-UC, 42%, actually diagnosed more kids. We have data on comorbidity that's interesting to look at, another way of supporting the validity of these diagnoses, because we know that if a person has PTSD, 70 to 90% of the time they have a comorbid disorder, and that's another way to support the validity of these diagnoses. And that's, so you can see the mean number of symptoms for the misclassified cases, the mean number of functional domains that are impaired, you know, out of a total possible of 6, and about 67 to 69% of the time, if they had one of these alternative diagnoses, they had a diagnosis of a comorbid disorder, which are listed in the bottom of the table there. And then also they had elevated CBCL scores. Now, the rates of comorbid disorder and the CBCL scores are not as high as those who were diagnosed by DSM-4, but that's kind of expected because the threshold is a bit lower. So I think this is other good evidence as a way to support the validity of this alternative diagnosis, is the high rates of comorbidity. Now, what about 7 to 18-year-old children? We're in a strange situation. Usually there's less known about preschool kids for everything in the world, almost. But with PTSD, we actually have been studying it better than we have teens and older children, in terms of diagnostic validity studies, at least. So there's not a lot out there at looking at alternative ways of diagnosing kids at this age group with PTSD. So I had to use a data set that we had. We just finished a study treating kids with CBT and D-cycloserine or placebo. And looking at just the 13 to 18-year-old group, first of all, if we applied an alternative algorithm, that same way we did in preschool kids, or using the new DSM-5 for preschool children, you can see the rates of whether they're not diagnosed or diagnosed are very, very similar to the DSM-4. 70% were diagnosed by DSM-4, 74% by the AA, 69% by DSM-5. That's really not a significant difference. So this suggests that DSM-4 is probably appropriate and okay for teenagers. However, the 7 to 12-year-old group, 65% were diagnosed by DSM, were not diagnosed by DSM-4, 30% were diagnosed by DSM-4, and then just flipped around using the PTSD AA, 65% qualified for the diagnosis of the alternative algorithm and 54% by the DSM-5 criteria. Again, so the question is, are we just diagnosing mildly symptomatic kids? Is this not a direction to go? But if you look at the misclassified cases, the mean number of symptoms is over 7 PTSD symptoms. They're impaired in more than 4 domains. And I think that's pretty suggestive evidence that 7 to 12-year-old kids might need a lower threshold, just like the preschool kids. So in conclusion, preschool children will have separate diagnostic criteria in the DSM-5. 7 to 12-year-old kids probably need modified criteria too, so we got work cut out for DSM-6. It should lead to huge increases in diagnosis. And that's all. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Justin Conardi from the University of Queensland, who will be speaking on PTSD as a gateway disorder for children.
Okay. Thanks very much, Pat. I want to just carry on a little bit from what Mike had been talking about. It's a lovely introduction to what I'm going to be saying. We know in adults that comorbidity in PTSD is pervasive, up to 80% comorbid at some time or another. That comorbidity tends to be depression, generalized anxiety disorder, and substance abuse. We also know that comorbidity tends to vary over time. For example, in Megan O'Donnell's study, and she's done a lot of work in comorbidity in adults, found that the relationship between depression and PTSD changed early on compared to what happened later. It tended to separate early and then became part and parcel of PTSD later. There's also a general view that PTSD is the constant. So even though it isn't necessarily at a diagnostic level, so there's always a post-traumatic stress process that's underlying perhaps expression of comorbidity, even if it isn't necessarily detected, because it might not meet the criteria, the diagnostic criteria. Also, there's a suggestion that comorbidity may just simply be reflecting premorbidity. So in other words, you only have comorbidity because the person had depression before the trauma. Okay. In children, it's a fairly similar story, but some differences. As Mike mentioned, PTSD is under-recognized in kids, and I would suggest, along with what Mike was saying, that this is true not just for preschool kids, but also for the school age, the primary school kids. And this may in part be because comorbidity is actually easier to recognise in kids. So behavioural expressions of traumatic stress are more likely to be diagnosed than the more internal states associated with PTSD. Also, PTSD diagnostic criteria may be inappropriate, as I mentioned before. Another interesting issue is that, contrary to belief, PTSD doesn't go away in kids. There tends to be an ongoing course, but it isn't necessarily PTSD that is diagnosed as something that's ongoing. It may be something that's sitting away below a clinical level. Another kind of difficult issue is this problem with age. As I mentioned, as Mike mentioned, there's a PTSD for preschoolers, but there seems to be something that changes around adolescence in terms of its expression. And the middle group, the kind of primary school age group, is the one where we're really unclear about what's going on. The comorbidity that exists in adolescence, it's suggested that there's more expressions of substance abuse and depression in adolescence, whereas with the younger kids, it's going to be ADHD, ODD, separation anxiety. And the question is, do these things change over time in a similar way to what Megan O'Donnell found? And what role does PTSD have in this function in this relationship? So I'm going to be talking to two aims, generally about the prevalence of psychological reactions early on and then later, not just trauma but also comorbidity, and also the relationships between PTSD or the expression of pure expression of PTSD and later reactions. So I'm going to be talking about two studies. The first study comes from a data set that Alex DeYoung collected. In this data set, it was 1 to 6-year-olds who all experienced traumatic burns. So it's 130 kids, and they were all assessed using Mike Schringer's interview measure, which yielded a PTSD AA criteria diagnosis, as well as a full DSM-4. This is the sample. Severity of the burn was relatively low, but you've got to understand that burn injuries in kids, what would be considered severe in kids would be much less than what would be so in adults, because it doesn't take much to have a life-threatening burn in a child, particularly in an infant. So if we're just looking at the figures, the rates, one thing to note here is the difference between the AA and the DSM-4 rates, this kind of order of magnitude difference in terms of the diagnosis, but also what you see is this other comorbidity that's occurring, particularly ODD and SAD, separation anxiety disorder, and some of that is premorbid, but a lot of it is actually new onset. Okay, so it's something new, and then you also see this kind of a very strong overlap with PTSD, particularly again ODD and separation anxiety. We don't see as much depression. When we look at that over time, so this is 6 months down the track, the PTSD has dropped away to about 10%. That doesn't mean that it's still not there grumbling away, but it's certainly that's what we're diagnosing under the AA criteria. But we also see new onset comorbidities rising up. And those new onset comorbidities are again largely in the ODD, SAD, and also ADHD areas. Okay. So from that data we can also look at the relationship between PTSD at 1 month and 6 months, other diagnoses, and we find that PTSD at 1 month is predictive of new non-PTSD diagnoses at 6 months, with an odds ratio of 4.8. and that all children with new onset PTSD diagnosis at 6 months had a minimum of one PTSD symptom at 1 month. So there's kind of like this, what I would suggest is gateway effect. Children with new onset non-PTSD diagnoses at 6 months had significantly more one-month post-traumatic stress symptoms than children with no new onset disorders at 6 months. Again, seeing this kind of effect. What about the older kids? And what about the other question is, well, what about if we look at what happens when we don't have any PTSD at 6 months? So those two questions I'm going to address with an analysis of a second data set. And this is children aged 7 to 16, but I would say that I would put the caveat in that most of the kids here are actually 7 to 13. There's very few. There's only about two or three who are actually 15 to 16. And this is an accident group, and we also happen to have a control sample here. In this case, we've used the ADAS-C, Wendy Silverman's measure, and it was a parent-based one. These are the age ranges and durations of admission and the injury severity scales. Accident cause, and these are the incidences. So again, we used the AA criteria, and we found, again, an order of magnitude difference in the diagnosis. And we find similar rates after 6 months of about 10%. The hospital control sample were just kids that were admitted to hospital for non-trauma reasons, and also non-life-threatening, I should say. So we didn't find any PTSD in that group. When we look at comorbidity, what we found was specific phobia, separation anxiety disorder were the things that tended to be higher, and they certainly were higher relative to the hospital control sample and higher than what you would expect to find in a general sample from figures that we could gather from the literature. Depression, no. We didn't find depression rates any higher than what you would expect to find in the population generally. And we found it similar to the similar rates in the hospital control sample. So I just showed you the internalising. These are the externalising disorders. And what we found here was the externalising problems are at higher rates in the hospital sample. The ADHD is dropping off a little bit more over time, but it's higher than what you would expect. This hospital control sample, I should say, was up to 1 month post admission. But overall, what you're seeing is more externalising. Now, keep in mind that internalising, externalising distinction, because that's important. When we look at the relationship between PTSD and these other disorders, what you find is not so much for specific phobias, but we're seeing strong relationships at 1 month between separation anxiety, generalised anxiety disorder, and all internalising diagnoses and PTSD at 1 month. And we're seeing some relationship exists with ADHD, but not so much with ODD at 1 month. When we look at that over 6 months, the relationship changes a little bit with internalising disorders. We still see generalised anxiety disorder. The separation anxiety disorder is dropping off a bit, but separation anxiety is still high. Overall, again, however, the internalising is very high, so there's a high association between the two. What happens though if we say, okay, if we have a diagnosis of PTSD at 1 month, what's the probability, what's the likelihood of having a comorbid disorder at 6 months without having PTSD at that 6 month time period? So that means where there's no PTSD at 6 months, but what other diagnosis exists? And what we see here is, yes, certainly with internalizing problems, the odds ratio is 8. So there's you're 8 times more likely to have an internalizing disorder, a new internalizing disorder at 6 months without the presence of PTSD. But that doesn't hold for externalizing. Okay, it's true for internalizing, but it's not true for externalizing. We can also look at it this way, where you have a logistic regression, stepwise logistic regression. If you enter 1 month internalizing diagnoses in as the first step, and then 1 month PTSD in as the second step, and you use as your DV internalizing diagnoses, what you find is a significant increment, so that there is this prediction controlling for this. Adding in the effect of PTSD diagnosis at 1 month. But that doesn't hold for externalizing. Okay, it's the same thing again, same story. Okay, so in summary, new non-PTSD diagnoses appear to develop in children following trauma and continue to develop over time. So you get new diagnoses occurring, once the PTSD has dropped away as a diagnosable disorder. The presence of PTSD early on predicts the development of later non-PTSD diagnoses, especially internalizing with or without later PTSD. And the diagnostic conceptualization of PTSD in children needs to take account of non-PTSD presentations that emerge over time after trauma. So I would argue that this study is indicating that PTSD does appear to provide a gateway function, but that the expression of that gateway function differs with age, certainly in these two data sets. Okay, so you see it much more so in the younger kids, but not as much across the board in the older kids. And that's it.
Thank you, Justin. That was fascinating. I am pleased to present our next speaker, Dr. Nancy Kasem Adams, who will be speaking on child acute stress symptoms, evidence and implications for diagnostic criteria.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Patricia, for organizing this symposium. It's been fascinating so far. So I'm going to change gears just a little bit and talk about post-traumatic symptoms that happen in the early days after trauma, and specifically the acute stress disorder diagnostic criteria as they've existed for DSM-4, as they're proposed for DSM-5. And I have no commercial relationships to disclose. I want to talk about a project where when we saw the proposed DSM-5 ASD symptoms, we were able to take advantage of something that was already happening, which was the product of this wonderful international project team, including Justin as one of the key collaborators. We created an international data archive of data sets from many prospective studies that had happened after child acute trauma around the world, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that data set, but we were able to use this large integrated data set from many studies to take a look at these proposed criteria and see how they measured up for kids. So we know that child, as we've already heard today, that child and adolescent responses may vary from those of adults. And this may also be true for the nature of those very early responses in the first couple days or weeks after a traumatic event. They may also vary in how they relate to what we would consider clinically significant distress or impairment that warrants clinical attention. And so we tried to use this data set to take a look at that question. The reasons for assessing acute traumatic stress responses, I think it's important that we specify why we're taking a look at this. In DSM-4, we've had two purposes. One is to certainly discern who needs current clinical attention, but the other was an explicit goal of predicting who would go on to have persistent post-traumatic stress. And one change with the DSM-5 work group is that they explicitly removed that second goal. So really the goal of the DSM-5 acute stress disorder formulation, as it's stated, is to really be that triage, to really say who needs clinical attention now and not to worry so much about whether that predicts ongoing disorder. So we thought that we could use, so here's a look at what the current DSM-4 criteria are and then the DSM-5 proposed criteria. As Michael mentioned earlier, the subjective experience piece of the event has been removed. And one of the biggest changes for acute stress disorder is that heavy focus on dissociation that's in DSM-4, where you needed to have 3 of 5 types of dissociation, that's been removed. There's a group of 14 symptoms, and the proposal is that you have any nine, without regard to symptom categories, of those 14. I will state right now that at the time we did these analyses, and we've since published this paper, the criterion then was 8, and one of the symptoms changed. So all the analyses that I'm showing you are just a little different from the current proposal, just a little. We've taken some quick looks at it. I don't think that anything I'm telling you would be different, but one symptom has shifted, and I'll show you what that is. The other slight change is the requirement that these have persisted for 3 days instead of 2. And again, in our data, we've looked at, I think it's 2 days of persistence. Again, we've taken a quick look, and that doesn't change any of these conclusions. So these are the 14, this is the list of 14 proposed symptoms in the DSM-5 current proposal. They are grouped into 4 categories, but again, the counting up of criteria is without regard to category. And the one thing that has changed, I know when I was sitting here, I couldn't see the bottom of the slides, the very bottom. At the time we did these analyses, agitation or restlessness had been added as a symptom. That has been removed, and concentration difficulties has been added back. And so now the proposal is 9 of these 14. So it's many of the usual suspects with a little bit broader, I think maybe easier to assess in kids set of dissociation symptoms without the sort of over, I think what I would argue were some over-specificity in the dissociation symptoms before. Okay, I think I've said that. So in our current analyses, we aim to take this international data archive that we happen to have at our disposal for another purpose. This is a great opportunity and also a way to sort of take it out for a run. We created it for the purposes of another prediction project. We are eager to keep adding data sets to it, and this is one of the reasons why, to have international data that is coded in common ways. We've done all this work to bring it all together, to have it available when questions like this come up or to be able to look at other analyses. So we want to just describe the prevalence of these particular 14 symptoms in this large sample of kids from multiple countries with different kinds of trauma, and then to examine those proposed symptom criteria in relation to the best measure we had of warrants clinical attention, which was we have concurrent functional impairment in many, many of these data sets. And I'll say this is this question of how do you distinguish some transient early acute stress reactions that, of course we'd want to support kids and families, but that from those that really warrant clinical attention. And we argued that one way to look at that, and certainly not the only way, but one way is to say, are they associated with functional impairment? Do these kids also report that they have some difficulty in social or academic or interpersonal functioning linked to those symptoms or at the same time as those symptoms in this acute period? So in this approach, we would argue that if the proposed ASD symptoms are good for kids, or developmentally appropriate, we ought to see that each individual symptom probably has some association with impairment, that having more of them is maybe associated with more impairment, and that the cutoff, that 8 or 9 symptoms, ought to be sensitive, ought to pick up on all the kids, or a large proportion of the kids who also are feeling impaired by these symptoms. So that's what we looked at. So the PTSD After Acute Child Trauma, the PACT data archive, currently has data sets from more than 20 prospective studies with more than 3,000 kids ages 2 and up, from 8 research teams in 5 countries and 4 languages. We love being able to say that, and hopefully it'll just keep getting more. In the current analyses, we looked just at those data sets that had the right kind of data, that had self-reported acute stress disorder symptoms. That was 15 data sets from these 4 countries. We limit it to ages 5 to 17 for many of the reasons that Michael, we just feel like younger kids are sort of a different animal. So the mean age in these analyses is around 11 or 12. We are heavy on the injury trauma, which means we are heavy on the boys, because that's what happens in injury samples for whatever reason. And we're about half ethnic minority, which I think is nice. It's very difficult to code ethnicity across countries and nationalities, because we all socially construct that differently. But we did figure out a way to figure out, are you an ethnic minority where you live? And so about half of this sample is an ethnic minority in the country where they are. The mean time to assessment, they had to be 2 days to 4 weeks, but the mean time to assessment is about 13 days. So we're getting kids, this is assessments of kids pretty early. And in 10 of those 15 data sets also had functional impairment ratings. So I'll show you prevalence across all 15 data sets, but when we start looking at how it relates to functional impairment, that's in just 10. So here is the prevalence of each of those DSM-5 symptoms. And they range from a low of about 14%, but I call that a significant minority. That's like 1 in 6, 1 in 7 kids reporting this, up to avoidance. Oh, I see this. I could see more of these words when I saw the slide this morning. I think that's avoiding thoughts, feelings, and conversations that is the most endorsed, the 50%. And then it's about 40%, again, in that slightly more limited data set of 1,100 kids who report some kind of functional impairment. Those numbers seem, you know, seem about right for what you might expect, a mean of 2 weeks or so post-trauma. They reported anywhere from 0 to 13 symptoms, with a median of 3 and a mean of 3.6. I know this is very probably too small to see all of it. The take-home from this table, from our paper, is that the proportion with impairment was significantly higher for each, looking at each symptom individually, did it predict whether you were also likely to have functional impairment. And for every symptom other than the last one, the one that's now been taken out, agitation or restlessness, that was true. That's probably a sample size issue for that last one. So I think we can say as the overarching message that each and every one of these symptoms had some relationship to functional impairment. So that's a good thing, I think. And then generally, more symptoms, more impairment. So this is just plotting the number, 0 to 13, that each child reported with the percentage of those kids who had impairment. So I don't remember how many had 13 symptoms. It wasn't very many, but they 100% of them reported functional impairment. We then looked, you know, really did sensitivity, looking at just as a prediction, do you meet the cutoff, placing the cutoff at different places, and how likely are we to find those kids who have functional impairment. And what's highlighted here was what was then the 8-symptom requirement. But you can look at the 8 or 9 symptom, they're about the same. Sensitivity of 0.25 means that of the kids who did report being impaired by acute stress reactions, at 8 or 9 symptom criteria would have only picked up about 25% of them. So it's not a very sensitive measure of finding the kids who have functional impairment. Specificity such that we're accurately finding those who don't. And if we sort of eyeball this table in terms of, you know, where do you want to, what's the trade-off you want to make between sensitivity and specificity, but also if we look at our RSC curve analyses, 3 to 4, which is quite different, really looks like the best place to sort of balance. You don't lose the percent correctly classified. If we move to 3 or 4, we get 2/3 to 3/4 of the kids with functional impairment get picked up. We lose some specificity, but I would argue that's probably okay for what we're likely to use the acute stress disorder diagnosis for. We're likely to use it to, you know, not swoop in and provide tons of psychotherapy, but to do more intensive watchful waiting, to do some more extensive support. And so these data really suggest that moving that criteria much lower for kids in this age range would, at least for kids with these kinds of traumas, might really pick up on those kids who need our attention better. And it's a dramatic difference, not just a slight difference. One other way of looking at it is how many meet the symptom criteria. The other thing the DSM-5 work group has suggested is that a good set of criteria would identify a minority of, we shouldn't be identifying everybody, we shouldn't be over-identifying. They report that 20% of adults in a couple of large data sets met the symptom criteria. We use that same cutoff here and had about 12%. So it looks like we're identifying about half as many as in samples of adults. And an 8-symptom criteria would have had, if you had to have the symptoms and also impairment, that would have identified only 10.5% of our sample versus 30% give or take for the lower criterion. We also took just a quick look at developmental differences within this sample, just at a very broad brush thing, but looked at the 5 to 11-year-olds separately from the 12 to 17-year-olds, and the picture is pretty much the same in each group. So in summary, I think this data suggests that this proposed list of symptoms does capture some important aspects of kids' and teens' experience in the immediate aftermath of trauma. They're certainly endorsed by, you know, significant minority in each case, up to half of kids in these studies in the early aftermath of events. Most of them are each associated with impairment, and so that I think is good in terms of picking up on what are the real things we want to be picking up on. Collectively, more symptoms, more impairment, so that seems to be a reasonable list of symptoms. However, this 8 or 9 symptom criteria really could miss many children who do probably need some clinical attention or at least support. And a 3 or 4 symptom criterion would improve sensitivity while retaining some reasonable specificity. So we would suggest that this get looked at further. Then some caveats, while this is a nice, large international sample and has some good diversity in several ways, age, ethnicity, et cetera, it is a limited range of acute trauma types. Just given the nature of the studies that are out there, this is a sample that's very heavy on injury and motor vehicle accidents, and it's possible this could look different after disaster, after other kinds of acute trauma. So this may not be the whole story. The other thing is that these were studies that mostly, you know, what we looked at here is the symptoms that are currently in the DSM-5 proposal. If there are other symptoms that would be even better for kids that ought to be included, this data doesn't shed light on those at all. I would like to thank the whole project team because many people's work went into this, and certainly our funders and all the kids and parents, in this case around the world, who participated in these studies. And here's the reference, because since we put in this abstract, it's actually come out. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nancy. Our last speaker is Diana Bennett from the University of Utah, who will be presenting some work from our lab designed to answer the question, is the dysphoric versus anxious arousal distinction relevant to youth?
Okay, so I'm going to be talking to you today about the factor structure of PTSD among traumatized youth. I also don't have any commercial relationships to disclose. Okay, so the current version of the DSM uses a 3-factor approach to diagnostic criteria, intrusion, also called re-experiencing, avoidance, and arousal. But this model has been criticized basically since it started, mostly because it was derived from expert consensus instead of actual empirical evidence. So since then, a number of studies have come up with alternate models, and this table highlights the differences in some of these more well-supported models that have been used. So we have the 3-factor DSM model, the King emotional numbing model, the Sims dysphoria model, and a newer 5-factor model by Elhai and colleagues. So the emotional numbing model basically is similar to the DSM model, except that it separates the avoidance and numbing criteria into 2 separate factors. The dysphoria model follows the idea that several symptoms of PTSD are actually indicative of more general distress. So they've actually combined the numbing symptoms with the first 3 arousal symptoms, which are difficulty sleeping, irritable and angry, and difficulty concentrating, to create more of a dysphoria factor. And finally, Elhai and colleagues have argued that symptoms D1 through D3 might actually represent a more unique construct of dysphoric arousal. So they've separated that out from anxious arousal. Those are different studies. Both of the 4-factor models have been supported in literature, but a recent meta-analysis actually supported the dysphoria model over the numbing model. And there's less work that's been done on this 5-factor model just because it is newer, but studies have also been supporting it above the other models. So, okay. There are a number of limitations in the previous research that's been done, these types of factor analysis studies. First, most of the decisions about which model should be preferred are just based on really small differences in the statistical model fit. Additionally, most of these models have been developed using adult military veteran samples, and we know that trauma can affect individuals differently depending on their developmental level, as we've seen people talk about today. Further, most other studies have ignored the role of gender in the PTSD symptom structure, so it's important for us to know whether these different models translate effectively to to samples of females as well, since we know that females tend to have higher prevalence rates of PTSD, and some studies have also shown that they've had higher, more severe symptom endorsement. And finally, many studies have used samples reporting on a singular traumatic event, for example, a natural disaster. But research has shown that the type of event is associated with differential risk for symptom endorsement for PTSD. One particular important distinction is between interpersonal traumas, such as physical abuse or rape, and non-interpersonal traumas like medical trauma or natural disasters. So we know that that's an important distinction that needs to be made. And youth involved in the juvenile justice system actually offer us a pretty unique contribution to this field of work. We know that the majority of these youth have experienced multiple traumatic events in their lifetime and also tend to have rates of PTSD that are much higher than the general population. And it's especially important to understand PTSD among this group as well, just because it's been linked with recidivism. So understanding the mechanisms through which that that link occurs is really important for us to understand. Okay, so establishing the predictive validity of PTSD symptom factors will help us kind of justify the selection of one model over another in a more meaningful way than just looking at statistical model fit. It gives us an idea of how this is actually affecting functioning. And the predictive validity to mental health problems can also help us to target treatment and to better understand comorbidity. Kidding, we're not done with that slide. Okay. So for youth involved in the juvenile justice system especially, understanding these links to mental health problems are really important as they relate to recidivism, because youth are more likely to continue on a delinquent pathway when they have unmet mental health needs. Okay. So the current study had three distinct goals. The first one was to determine which one of these different models fit best in our sample. We also wanted to understand how the factors of the best-fitting model were differentially associated with interpersonal and non-interpersonal trauma exposure. And we wanted to understand how the factors of the best-fitting model were associated with mental health problems. So we used a sample of over 1,300 adolescents who were detained in juvenile detention centers at two different locations across the country. They were between 11 and 18 years old with an average of about 15 and a half, and this was a fairly ethnically diverse sample. So to assess trauma exposure and PTSD symptoms, we use the UCLA PTSD Reaction Index, which the first part of the measure has youth endorse different types of traumatic events that they've experienced, and then it goes on to ask them about their symptom presentation within the past 30 days. And the Massachusetts Youth Screening Instrument is the most widely used measure of mental health problems among juvenile detention settings, and this measure is typically administered to youth within the first 24 hours that they enter the detention setting. It has five scales that have been validated for use with males and females. They're shown here. And as you can see, these are items that are intended to measure mental health problems. So, for example, the substance use scale doesn't actually measure things like experimental substance use that we know would be common in this type of a sample, but instead it's actually trying to get at risk for developing serious substance abuse problems. Most youth in our sample had experienced multiple traumatic events. It's of note that girls did endorse more interpersonal trauma exposure as well as more PTSD symptoms. There was no difference between boys and girls on non-interpersonal trauma exposure. I'll also mention really quickly that for our sample, about a third of the girls met full DSM-IV criteria for PTSD, but two-thirds of the girls would meet partial criteria. And for boys, we had about a fifth that would meet full criteria and about half that would meet partial criteria for PTSD. So we also know that girls had significantly higher scores on each of the scales for mental health problems that we measured, except for alcohol and drug, which there was no differences between boys and girls. So our first goal was to determine which model fit our data best, and we connected all these analyses in M+. I know there's a lot of information on this slide, so just to point out that underneath this table are basically the numbers we want to see for adequate and good fit of these models. And you can see that all of the models were an adequate fit, but the five-factor model was closest to being a good fit in our sample. They're actually arranged here in order from worst fitting to best fitting. Okay, and we determined that using chi-square difference testing for the nested models, and we used the bit comparison for the two non-nested four-factor models. So basically, the five-factor model fit best in our sample. And we also looked at this separately for girls and boys to determine if it was fitting best for each of those groups, and we found that it was when we looked at them separately. So Okay, having selected the five-factor model as the best-fitting model, the next step was kind of to determine the how trauma exposure were related to those factors and how those factors are related to mental health problems. So this is a quick indicator of our PATH model. You can see that it actually was a good fit to the data. It's important to note that this data was collected cross-sectionally, so we can only speak of statistical prediction and not actual causation or temporal prediction. So just point that out as we move forward. Okay, so here is the portion of the model where we tested how trauma exposure was associated with the five factors that we were looking at, and we also looked at how gender moderated those paths. So we found that for both boys and girls, interpersonal trauma was associated with each of the five factors of PTSD symptoms. For boys, we found that non-interpersonal trauma was associated with four of the five symptom clusters, so all of them except for numbing, whereas for girls, non-interpersonal trauma was only associated with anxious arousal. Okay, so although it looks like they do have different patterns here, we tested this for moderation by gender, and we actually found that those weren't significantly different, so it's not moderated by gender. Could be because we have more boys than girls in our sample, but that's something that we're still looking into. Okay, so our final question was looking at how the five factors were associated with mental health problems and also looking at whether gender would moderate those connections. And I should also note that on these, we did allow the factors to correlate, so the five factors of PTSD symptoms were allowed to correlate, as were the factors for the mental health problems. So what we found was that for boys, intrusion was significantly associated with depression and anxiety, as well as somatic complaints. For girls, there were no associations between intrusion and any of the mental health problems that we looked at. For boys, there were no associations with avoidance and any of the mental health problems that we looked at. Whereas for girls, we did find a negative relationship between avoidance and anger and irritability. And this is actually the only negative path that I'll be showing to you, so just keep in mind that all the rest of them are a positive association. For boys, we found that numbing was associated with depression and anxiety, as well as suicidal ideation. And for girls, numbing was associated with anger and irritability and depression and anxiety. For boys, the dysphoric arousal factor was linked with anger and irritability, depression, anxiety, and somatic complaints. And for girls, it was alcohol and drug problems, anger, irritability, depression, anxiety, and somatic complaints. For boys, there were no links with anxious arousal in any of the five factors, whereas for girls, we found that anxious arousal was associated with suicidal ideation. So to kind of bring all of these things together, this is what it's looking like for boys and for girls. Hopefully this is making sense now. We do see a few key conclusions that emerge here. Basically that we are seeing differential effect of the dysphoric and anxious arousal clusters. So it looks like dysphoric arousal is a really important predictor of these different types of mental health problems that might be missed in the other factor models where that distinction isn't being made. So in looking at whether these paths were moderated by gender, we found no difference in terms of how PTSD symptoms were associated with alcohol and drug problems for boys and girls. But we found that the path was stronger for boys in looking at PTSD symptoms as they associate with anger and irritability. And for girls, we found that the paths were stronger on more of these internalizing mental health problems, so depression, anxiety, somatic complaints, and suicidal ideation. So a few conclusions beyond that. Basically, we established in our sample that the DSM-4 model was inadequate compared to the other models in terms of how it was actually fitting the symptom presentation of these youth. This is especially timely as we know the DSM-5 is being developed right now, as the other speakers have mentioned. And these findings especially call into question this idea from the DSM that you need to have endorsed criteria from each cluster. As we see here, traumatized youth sometimes rely on certain strategies in place of others to cope with PTSD, and so that can result in endorsing different sets of symptoms that have different implications for mental health functioning. And our model fit comparison suggested a better fit for the five-factor model as compared to the other ones that we tested. And we did this in a fairly ethnically diverse sample of adolescent boys and girls, most who had been exposed to multiple types of trauma. So this adds to the literature that supports the five-factor model by basically applying it to more diverse samples. And based on our findings, we also found that interpersonal and non-interpersonal trauma appear to be important in developing these different factors. This expands on what have mostly been studies looking at singular traumas, for example, individuals who have been exposed to an earthquake. by suggesting that the model has a greater utility in capturing the symptom responses in a wide range of trauma. And finally, this study adds to literature by providing some evidence for the predictive validity of individual clusters. Studies have usually stopped at kind of identifying which model fit best in their sample without looking further. So this gives us some, it's basically been argued that in order to justify the preference for this five-factor model over some of the more parsimonious ones, such as the four-factor models that have been well-supported, we need to have a more meaningful case to argue for the separation between the dysphoric and anxious arousal clusters. So we did see here different patterns of associations with mental health problems for girls and boys, and most notably that dysphoric arousal seems to have a lot more associations with mental health problems as compared to this anxious arousal cluster, which was only predictive of suicidal ideation for girls. And we also think that these findings have important implications for juvenile justice-involved youth in particular. As we identified different patterns between boys and girls, there has been a big movement in looking at girls' delinquency specifically and understanding how different pathways might be at play, and I think that our findings here do support that. And so finally, we identified a few future directions based on this work. Since we did find some different associations in terms of what was linked with suicidal ideation for boys and girls, we believe that including a more comprehensive measure that might also include self-harm could kind of get at those distinctions a little better. So specifically that was for boys, connection with numbing, and for girls it was anxious arousal. So in understanding how those mechanisms work differently, a more extensive measure might be helpful. We also believe that age might play a role in understanding how these links between trauma and mental health problems are looking. So perhaps looking at younger adolescents versus older adolescents in terms of how mental health problems are manifest. And we also know that girls tend to have experienced higher levels of interpersonal trauma, which is associated with symptoms of complex PTSD, such as numbing. And theories have suggested that numbing, in particular, has played a particular role in delinquency. So one area of research might be to include outcomes in a study such as this of severity of delinquency. And that's all I have for you. So thanks.
Thank you, Diana. We have time for questions. If people would want to come up to the mic so that they get recorded, we'd be very glad to engage in some discussion. You were all much too clear.
Nothing to ask.
Jeff, please, yeah.
I can't remember if your data sets would allow this, but you looked at PTSD earlier on, predicting comorbidity. Did you look the other way around? So the other comorbid things at time one, predicting the existence or more PTSD at time two.
PTSD.
Yeah.
excuse me. Our data sets would allow it.
Okay.
I haven't done it.
Please.
Yeah. Again, I'd like to thank everybody for a very stimulating presentation. I'm almost reluctant to ask this because, this is really fine work for all the presenters have presented on establishing four factors versus five, looking at different criteria at different ages. But I think, Nancy, you said something at the end of your talk that I think is really significant. I wonder if the others could comment on it as well. When you said that, if we don't, this is all looking at the existing symptoms and how they manifest in kids at different ages and different types. What if there's other symptoms? And, another way of looking at that is in the second presentation, there was discussion about some of these comorbidities that start at different times. Well, what if we didn't think of them as comorbidities but said, that is the way PTSD manifests in those kids. That's just their presentation of a trauma reaction. It might be interesting to know if, for example, separation anxiety following trauma is in some way experientially different than separation anxiety that doesn't follow trauma. Same with ODD and ADHD. I mean, a metaphor that came to mind is not a perfect metaphor for this, but if we have a little kid and we try to put him in a man's suit, it's not going to fit. We can take in the seams. We can chop off the arms and legs. It's still going to be a man's suit on a little kid.
great question. There are other symptoms that show up in, like, preschoolers, for example. And they may be some of the more common symptoms. We've shown this empirically: separation anxiety, fear of the dark, when dark has nothing to do with their trauma, regression in developmental skills, enuresis. And we've looked at, if we add those to the diagnostic criteria, does it help? And it doesn't help. That doesn't. So then you get into the situation of, what are the diagnostic criteria there for? Is it to capture every single symptom that people show? Or can you just put those extra symptoms into other things like checklists and measures that can you just use them for severity, and you don't have to worry about them for diagnoses? So maybe that's a way to kind of, one way to keep things different is, what do we need in a diagnostic criteria so that it's concise, manageable, but still accurate? And what do we need in severity checklists to use for predicting outcomes? That's not answering all of your parts about it. This kind of, you know, there's debates out there about completely changing PTSD, coming up with different diagnostic sets. And one way I like, my personal way to think about it is, I like the comorbidity system that we have. I really liked Diane's presentation that kind of tried to tackle all the different comorbid paths instead of trying to lump everything. I'm more of a splitter. For example, if the DSM-6 comes out with twice as many disorders as the DSM-5, I would be happy with that. I know a lot of people aren't, but the brain is so complicated, and people are so complicated. To me, if we can handle that diversity, that doesn't confuse me. I don't see it as a conundrum. I see it as, we're able to talk about the complexity of it all in different ways. So I can go on and on about that, but I'll pause right there.
I think a really important point that you made, and is implied in all this, is, what are the diagnostic criteria for? And they really serve a very, they're designed to serve a very limited purpose. They'll always be, we often confuse the map with the territory. We act as if it's there, that is what it is. They're useful. We don't want them to limit who can get services, who can, in our country, where we need them to get paid, or who can get their services paid for. But we shouldn't confuse that. That is not in the DSM. It's not part of the disorder.
And perhaps just to add a little bit more to what Mike said about comorbidity, a really good example is where you've got a functional relationship between the trauma and the expression of that trauma, and that may be a misdiagnosed ADHD or it may be ODD. It doesn't mean that that isn't an expression of it. It may mean that you have to think differently about how you treat it. You need to think about that functional relationship between the expression of the distress and the precipitant of it. And I think that's something that we kind of forget sometimes.
Yeah, based on what we've been looking at in my lab, I would second Justin's comment very much so, that youth who have these different sets of symptom clusters probably will respond to different treatments that target those symptom clusters. So trying to force them all into one description of what is PTSD may not do us the best service at all. I'm thinking, too, of the work that Julian Ford has done, trying to step out of the box of PTSD as the one and only consequence that we might see of trauma among juvenile justice-involved kids. In some of their samples, they find that classic PTSD is not a particularly highly endorsed diagnosis, but that doesn't mean that the other diagnoses that we aren't seeing as highly prevalent aren't related to the youth's experience of trauma. other questions, comments? It's too close to lunch. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.